Welcome to the Good Dog Pod. Join us every other Wednesday when we discuss all things dogs, from health and veterinary care to training and behavior science, as well as the ins and outs of Good Dog and how our platform can help you successfully run your breeding program. Follow us and join Good Dog's mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them. I'm Nicole. I'm Good Dog's community lead, for those of you who don't know me. Thank you all for joining us for another Good Breeder webinar. Today, we are going to be covering managing the oops pregnancy with our guest, Dr. Andrea Hesser, who has blessed us with her presence many, many times this year already. So we're so grateful to have her back with us. So just a quick overview of what we're going to cover today. As I'm sure many breeders know, an accidental breeding can cause havoc, which is why today Dr. Hesser is going to review the medical and surgical options for terminating an accidental pregnancy, including those available in the US and other countries. And the focus is specifically going to be on dogs that you intend to breed in the future. So really excited to get into this topic. I want to thank our friends at Purina for, of course, helping us bring this webinar to life and bring it to all of you. We've already hosted so many webinars this year, so I just want to remind everyone where all of those recordings live in case you've missed some, in case this is your first time joining us, which in that case, very exciting. As always, with these presentations, we're going to have a dedicated Q&A session at the end, and we're going to try to prioritize some of the previously submitted questions that we received already. I want to just share a little bit more about Good Dog in case it's anyone's first time joining us for one of our webinars. Good Dog is on a mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them by advocating for dog breeders like yourselves, educating the public, and promoting canine health and responsible dog ownership. We're a secure online community that is created just for responsible breeders to connect with quality Good Dog applicants from all across the country to find forever homes for your puppies. We help breeders run all aspects of their breeding programs from start to finish, from getting your litters listed, connecting with Good Dog buyers, receiving dog payments securely, and all of those smaller things that happen in between a litter of puppies being born and going off to their new homes. Good Dog is there to support you every step of the way in that. So if you're not yet a member of our community, we would love to have you join us. And you can apply at gooddog.com/join or just learn a little bit more about our mission there. And before I pass things over to Dr. Hesser, I just want to share a little bit more about her and her background in canine health for anyone who has not joined us for the past few webinars we've had with her. Dr. Hesser is a board-certified reproductive veterinarian who practices in small animal medicine in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Her clinical time is spent doing general practice veterinary medicine and reproductive consultations and surgery. Dr. Hesser also provides semen collection and health testing services at local dog shows. She is a longtime canine breeder herself and enthusiast with an interest in Whippets and Bull Mastiffs. Her mission is to serve breeders by helping them achieve their goals with their breeding programs, which is why she's here today and we could not be more lucky to have her. So with that, Dr. Hesser, I'm going to pass things over to you for our presentation.
All right. Thanks, Nicole. I appreciate the introduction. I know you guys are probably very sick of hearing the same spiel over and over, so I have spared you on my own slide. But yeah, if you guys ever need anything, reach out. I do practice in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metro and I stay busy. I apologize if you guys try to get hold of me and I'm a little bit behind, but often it's because I'm doing things like this. So I wanted to go over this as a topic for you guys because I think it happens to all of us. No matter how effectively we manage our own programs, we're all married to people, many of us, that don't have dogs as far as their background goes. And sometimes I would say the most common scenario that we hear is, I left for the weekend and my spouse was at home and he didn't know that he wasn't allowed to let Sasha out with Troy and they tied in 30 seconds and he called me frantic. So it's stressful. So a lot of times it's things like that. Sometimes it's other scenarios. I have had dogs that went with professional handlers that ended up getting accidentally bred. I think certainly if you have I worry all the time, like with travel for myself. I've just been traveling a lot in the last month and I have a bitch due in season at my house. And it's a really easy house to manage whenever nobody's in season, as far as just letting the dogs commingle. I have a technician that works with me who I specifically have come during time frames where I think she might come in season, because if I'm gone for 2 weeks, I could have a bitch in standing heat when I come back. And if the person that was taking care of the dogs didn't know better, they might not realize that. I think sometimes too, it's a lot of you guys that have toys specifically. So many, we didn't realize this happened, and the bitch just starts looking pregnant when she's like 7 weeks gestation. And we're already way past the point of kind of observing the tie. There are certain breeds, I would say also, that owners claim they can't naturally breed. And guess what? It does happen. So lots of different scenarios. So I think none of us are above them. I've had everyone from, "This is my first dog, I'm so embarrassed," to, "I've been breeding for 40 years and I swear I did not think it was possible that a miniature dachshund could breed a Dalmatian bitch, but she laid down for him and I watched it happen." So there's all sorts of variety. So before we get into all of that though, I just wanted to give you guys a little brief update on Zest. So she is growing and she's a weed. She's currently 62 pounds. So goal weight for this breed, we expect bitches to be somewhere between 100 and 120. Her mom is about 115. This puppy has a little bit more bone than her mom, so I do think she's probably going to be a little bit on the higher end of the breed standard. But we'll see. At 62 pounds, she could exceed it. So 5-month-old puppy, 62 pounds is quite impressive. She's not a heavy puppy. I've kept her pretty light, just given all her orthopedic concerns. So at this point, we're done with consultations. Basically, the last consultation I had with veterinarian, a good friend of mine from Oklahoma, basically, we were exploring the idea. There was a paper about, could we go in and surgically move her, the muscle that is attached to her femur bone, so that whole front of her thigh, could we lift that up and continue to like try to get more flexion in her knee with like an apparatus that they place, but they'd go in surgically and do some things. We also talked about CT potentially to try to figure out exactly what all the anatomy is, since it's so unusual. But basically, Dr. Jewell that I visited with, he just said, with how functional she is on it, I would not touch it. Because as soon as we go do something, if she is using it and bearing weight and running around on it, like fine, even if she's not 100% sound, it's better to leave it alone, is basically the discussion. And we also talked about total hips. I think we mentioned this as a thought for that side. It's possible that it could be done, but most of the people I'm consulting with are like, I would turf it to somebody else. I would turf it to somebody else because they are concerned about, since the muscular anatomy is not the same, can we assume that a total hip will function like it should? Will she really benefit from it? And it's obviously a pretty involved procedure, expensive procedure, and lots of post-op care. I don't know that she needs it at this point. Now she's half of her adult weight right now, so we'll see how she does when she's a little bit further along. Rehab vet side of things, they are amazed at how much muscle she's retained. So I'll show you some pictures, but we basically are just adjusting her monthly and haven't done much since she was about 3.5 months old or 4 months old. They have recommended myosupplementation as part of her, as like a pulsatile thing, as part of her care, as well as pulsatile Adequan treatment. So Adequan is a PSGAG material that we use as an injectable that basically helps the joints that she has that are normal, more so than the abnormal joint, just to benefit the kind of longevity of those joints and the health of the joint fluid. So they've recommended at least probably every 6 to 12 months, but at least every 12 months doing a loading dose, which is a twice a week injection for a month. That's usually the loading dose that people will use, like for an older dog or a sport dog that's kind of chronically going to be on the medication for benefit. So that's kind of the plan there. It's currently pain-free. That is from what we can tell. I didn't use an animal communicator, and don't judge me for that, right? Like I'm the doctor, I know. I know it's there's The science has its place. I think there is some lore beyond science that sometimes is of interest. I wanted to know, is she painful? Is that why she's like kind of constantly uses her leg abnormally? Is it just functional that she sits, her knee is fixed and kind of she walks more like a peg leg on that leg? Is that why she kind of walks abnormally? I can't elicit pain. She never responds painfully. So it's just hard for me to tell, is she painful? Is she just not acting painful? Because she's a tough bull mastiff puppy, and like she can literally run herself straight into a wall, and she's like, okay, and she keeps running. It's tricky. But she still has no range of motion in the knee. Her hip is subluxated because of all that chronic tension from the knee. So her hip joint, we cannot like really even gather how to approach it. Her, fortunately, the right hip, so her left hip is the one that's affected. Her right hip has a fantastic pendant score. So her hips wanted to be phenomenal. And at least the side where she does bear most of her weight is really excellent. But since that hip is not in like fixed in socket as tightly, the limb is slightly shorter stationed. So if you think about, since that joint doesn't sit in station, it sits slightly out. So it will raise up a little bit when you put pressure on it. It's higher station. And the limb also is shorter. A long time ago, you guys can go back and review those, the masterclass entries, but she did have a crush injury due to the extreme pressure from that kind of mechanical process that was going on with the front of her leg. She had basically a crushed proximal tibia, which is like the top part of the tibia. It basically looked like it was smushed a little bit. And we thought maybe she wasn't going to grow the length of leg that she did. But she's actually grown pretty symmetrically, and she's got normal proprioception. So she still walks. She never like drags her toes or walks on the top of her foot. I can tell you she hates having her nails done, including that foot. She can absolutely feel those toes with full sensation and does not appreciate her nails. I'm just curious on if she's painful at all, because I do want to be have grasp of that. So I've considered an animal communicator. I had a friend that kind of dabbled in it that does not feel like she is painful actively, like it's more than just discomfort would be. But I haven't really like pulled the trigger on actually going out on it. But you can see, so here's some examples of pictures of her. Oh, I should say too, this is a couch that she is on. She gets up there all by herself. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. She basically will use her front end and then place her rear end so that she has good proximal kind of spacing from the couch. And he kind of leans forward and uses her good side to be the lever to get up fully onto the couch. But you can see, like in these pictures, she kind of always points her toe like a ballerina kind of forward, but she uses that leg constantly. She's not limping, like she's not like hopping around on three legs, if that makes sense. She's never done that other than when she had that really bad kind of fever episode when we got a really good flexion exercise on her. But at least for now, so the plan is let her be a dog. I'm going to complete her health testing and reevaluate her. You know, if she gets older, it's still possible she could become an amputee. It's still possible she could get a total hip. I mean, there's a lot of things that are possible. We don't know at this point. I think it's pretty unlikely I will breed her. I'm actually going to breed the sire that I use, this frozen semen that I used. I'm going to breed to the son of that dog that had been available to me previously. I just really liked the idea of using his dad. So I will be breeding to this puppy, her mom, back to her half brother, basically. So it's pretty close to what I tried to accomplish with her. So hopefully I get a her from that litter and she could just be a dog. I can tell you she will never leave my house. You know, like as far as I'm not going to place this puppy. She's too fun and special, and I spent too much time kind of optimizing things. The last thing I want is to hand that off and then assume that somebody else is going to do the same level of things that I would do for her. I'm just maybe too protective mom at this point. But yeah, it's not off the table that I could breed this dog. I think, you know, the idea was we were trying to get her kind of like a brood mare or a mare that's included in a breeding program. Maybe that mare is not the dressage mare, but it was the sister of a really epic dressage mare. And that mare might still, even if she's not perfectly sound, she still may be able to produce foals that are wonderful. And I think it's a magic question. This is a really like weird scenario, and I think adding weight to her body is the question. We just don't know, you know, if she gets pregnant and she's dysfunctional, I think she can handle it. But if she gets pregnant and she's not dysfunctional, I think she's right on the line of being able to handle her weight with the way that her leg kind of works for her. Okay, so back to the purpose of our talk here. Sorry, I know I just wanted to update you guys on her because I figured a lot of you guys were curious. So we're going to talk about kind of the day that it happens, if you witnessed it. Sometimes you don't, but if you did kind of see the tie happen or you know what to do in that scenario, we're going to talk a little bit about why we don't have canine morning after pills. I know a lot of people call frantically as soon as they have this happen and they want to come in today. And the reality is I don't want to spend your money when there's nothing to be done. Medical termination options, we're going to go through the kind of protocol that I use just as an example protocol. There's a lot of protocols out there. Mine is not the only one. You may have used a completely different protocol, different approach, different timelines to injections and things if you have had this kind of experience before. We're also going to talk about if we lived elsewhere, i.e., pretty much anywhere but the United States, one of the drugs that's available frequently in a lot of those other countries. That is great. If we ever have it, it'll give you a little bit of kind of examples of how we would use it. There are some people who have gotten it, maybe not through super legal process, and are using it and saying it's off label, but technically there is a drug that's technically not legal to use without individual allowance by the FDA. And then we are going to talk a little bit about surgical termination options. I know for most of you guys, that might be something you're counseling others about more than for our kind of group, since we are often medical termination is something where we want her uterus and ovaries to stay because we would like to go forward with them in our breeding programs, and or we want to keep them intact for other reasons, maybe avoid surgery for other reasons. Surgical termination options, I would say the vast majority of phone calls, that is where we end up because people don't want to spend the money that it takes and dedicate the time that it takes to do a termination medically if the end goal is, well, we were going to stay her in a few months anyways, or she's already had her last litter and we're not interested in breeding her again. I think those situations carry a very different outcome with pursuing surgery rather than medical treatment. So the first thing that you do whenever it just happened is you panic, right? So like we talked about, we get these phone calls. These are probably, we probably get a phone call, I would say minimum once a week. And a lot of times it's not you guys. It's a lot of times it's the owner that was waiting to spay until 18 months because they had bought from a breeder like you guys and they don't know what they're doing. And they took the dog to the dog park and the dog got bred because they didn't even know it was in season. That kind of stuff happens all the time, unfortunately. I think that's one of the main reasons why I think it's a little bit, it's with great intention that we try to micromanage our who we sell to keep them from staying at young ages, since we know there's some kind of gray areas and pros and cons that we're creating by doing so. But I do think, at least in the US, we're selling puppies in the US to owners and not to other breeders. It's a really hard expectation, and this just happens. But again, it can happen to anybody. I mean, it is the great equalizer of, you own intact dogs, this can happen. And sometimes you don't even know what happened, right? So like sometimes you see it and you panic and you saw the tie, or you let the dogs in the yard and forgot that you had Frank in the yard, but it just sometimes that happens. Some of the dogs are fast. So everybody really wants to do something today. They just bred. Can't we give her a steroid shot? That's what my old vet used to do. They used to all give them steroid shots. Well, they probably did that, and your dog's bred, but they didn't create a pregnancy, or that pregnancy didn't carry to 4 weeks, like when we're going to check them. Steroids are not for this species, for dogs, and we're talking 100% for dogs in this talk, but just to mention some other species here. Steroids are not effective at terminating pregnancy in dogs. They are effective in terminating pregnancy early in some livestock species at different points in their gestation. So different species have different rules, but the ruminant group, so cows, sheep, goats, those guys generally can be affected at some point in their progress. If we give them steroids, it causes the corpus luteum, is what CL stands for, causes the CL to progress at certain stages. So you can actually abort like a cow at certain stages. If you just give a steroid injection, it will cause abortion for that cow. We don't do that very often. Obviously, the goal with most cows is to get them pregnant and have them carry a baby, but we know there's some specific timelines to this. Dog CL, so the corpus luteum for dogs, will not regress if she isn't pregnant. It's simply because she just didn't get pregnant. Sometimes they just don't get pregnant. So it was the generalization of saying all species do the same things. We know they don't. And now we have more evidence to say like that really doesn't work. So even if it's $15 at your local farm vet and he wants to do it, don't bother. And if she gets pregnant, don't wish that you had done it. You didn't need to do it. Things you could do today, like could. You could run a progesterone or run a cytology. So it is possible for dogs to breed non-estrus bitches. So I've had it. I have had more than one client. It's usually after heat. I've had more than one client, actually, many times it's frozen semen, where a really just hopped up stud dog says, "Ooh, I really like you today." And we know, we bred her with frozen semen a week ago. We know she's in diestrus. We know she can't get pregnant from that. And owners often call in a panic, relating to that because they're worried about the potential impact on their puppies. In my experience, they have all gotten pregnant despite that with the frozen dog. But if you got a cytology and the cytology says she's not in heat, well, then maybe that gives you some peace of mind not to panic. Running a progesterone and a cytology would be best if you can run both. But I know sometimes it depends on who you have available that might be able to read those types of numbers and things and interpret for you. But basically, if she seems like she's in heat and her progesterone was 0.2 and she stays out of heat for and she stays out of heat, she stays in proestrus, so early estrus, stays there for another week or two, well, maybe you've got pretty solid evidence not to worry. But I think that would at least give you some perspective on when to check her. We don't usually get that information, but I think, if we could, I think that would be something you could do. And just remember that, from a breeding, they can be bred and semen can stick around for 2 weeks and still get her pregnant. So it's a really rough situation when you have this happen to a dog that you are planning on breeding this cycle, and she's going in for her pre-breeding exam tomorrow, and she got bred by a dog in your house today, and you had all these glorious plans of using chilled semen from Canada and, all this stuff. You can do all that. The first dog that bred her might have already set up shop and might win the battle. So if it's something that you don't mind having that litter first, I would say a lot of people, I would just write it out unless she's an older bitch or you have high confidence that the dog did not cause the pregnancy. On that note, you can check your stud dog, right? So like some owners will sentimentally keep a dog that they weren't going to use, but they enjoy him and he's 11, and they haven't bred him since he was 4, and they didn't like what he produced, so they didn't breed him again, but they didn't neuter him. That dog might be sterile, right? We go collect semen from that dog, and he has no sperm. Well, then go breed to the dog from Canada and don't have any worry about it. Sometimes we can't check the stud dog, sometimes you don't know who it was. I have a friend that lived in the country that had just a neighbor dog that would sometimes come over to her property, but she had 40 acres, and she let her dogs run on 40 acres. So she did not expect to see multiple solid black puppies, which her breed does not come in solid black. But then she realized that that black dog that's running around probably bred her when she was out running in the field. Now, is that a good way to manage your dogs? I mean, you can't keep them up completely when they're in heat, right? For 2 weeks, you can't like lock them in a box. But sometimes I think that's a safe approach, depending on where you live. All right, so I know we were talking about the corpus luteum. On the diagram on the left, the yellow structure is that CL. So in the dog, since they ovulate a whole bunch of follicles, that's basically what takes up shop after they ovulate. So that corpus luteum is what produces progesterone and maintains pregnancy. For most species, it's not going to declare her pregnant, but it's to maintain pregnancy. So on the right, and I should caution you guys, there are some images. This is a pathology image. There's some images like this, especially toward the latter part of the talk, that are a little bit graphic, like aborted puppy kind of graphic. So just know that that is possible. And I apologize if anybody is a little bit squeamish. I know we're a little bit around lunchtime. So on the right, though, so those round structures that are kind of yellowish in color. Again, I can't really tell too well since this is not a super fresh specimen, but you can see the kind of circular guys, and then there's some kind of pink tissue in between. The pink tissue in between is not the focus, it's the yellow, kind of circular yellow guys. So those are all different spots. So this dog, and this is just a couple of sections here, but this dog at least ovulated 5 eggs, basically, is what I can tell you from this appearance. So all of those spots would have been places where she ovulated, and then they kind of formed in, created a CL, and started to create progesterone. So how often will she get pregnant? I think people want to like have like an odds ratio here. I think there's just so much to factor in, right? I would say if she's an older bitch and it's an old stud dog or something like that, well, what are the chances that his semen's going to be sturdy, that she would have been able to get pregnant? Like, how many times do we breed our own dogs with all these bells and whistles, perfect progesterone timing, excellent semen, and she doesn't get pregnant? And we bred them with the perfect timing. And so every once in a while, that will happen where they just didn't get pregnant. I think stud dog age is a big kind of consideration for me. If this is a one-year-old dog, prepare that she's going to be pregnant. If he's 1 or 2 years old and he bred her and she stood for that breeding, I mean, the likelihood that his sperm is going to stick around is high. My personal hands, I'd probably say 10% of the time when we come in for these consultations, they're not pregnant. It does happen. It can happen. And for all the same reasons that they sometimes, we talked in some of the other talks about infertility, all those things could be present, right? Like she might be at a place where she can't get pregnant, or maybe this cycle, she had an infection and she couldn't get pregnant, or she got super hot when she was outside running around. And I will say, if the plan is to terminate pregnancy, I do not treat them like they're made of glass. I make sure to tell the owners, if you want to run her twice as much in agility just to, you know, because she likes it and you want to disadvantage the likelihood that she's going to get pregnant, I mean, I think it's perfectly fine. If they've got an ear infection, we treat it. You know, we don't stay away from drugs that we would be afraid of during pregnancy, or, you know, flea tick medication, or, you know, whatever it is that the dog needs. Treat the dog in those scenarios, because if the end goal is we know we're not going to carry this litter to term, it doesn't really, I mean, I hate to say it, it doesn't matter, but we're not inflicting pain by making those choices. If those fetuses would have been terminated regardless, then I would say, you know, that's perfectly reasonable to make those types of choices. So I think, yeah, in summary, basically, when we try to do everything right, she won't get pregnant. When we do nothing and a random stray dog breeds her in the yard, she'll be pregnant every time. That's just the way that, like, the world works, right? So just as a mention, the early cycle, so early diastasis, which is like right after the progesterone starts to rise, that time frame is just bomb-proof for these dogs. They are very resilient to termination, like we talked about. Steroids don't touch them. And just as I mentioned, we don't actually know if the dog has a maternal recognition of pregnancy marker, which is the way that we describe something where we can measure something in your blood, or you can pee on a stick and you are producing some hormone that is unique to pregnancy that helps tell the body, stop trying to cycle, I'm making a pregnancy. So for most species that have estrous cycles, so things like cats, cows, horses, when they are able to cycle, so there's some seasonality to some species, but when they're able to cycle, they will cycle every few weeks, like 2 or 3 weeks is an estrous cycle, and then they will cycle again, they will cycle again, they will cycle again. Dogs don't work that way, right? So that's why dogs don't really follow those rules. But for other species like people, that's why we have an EPT. That's why we have drugs that are specific kind of to terminate pregnancy, because it just works a little bit different. The dog was designed to maintain a pregnancy after every ovulatory cycle, period. So just as a reminder, I know you guys have seen this before. So the pregnant dog and the non-pregnant dog have the exact same hormone profile. There's no difference. And I should say to ignore the fertile period on this. I know I stole this graph, but fertile period basically ends at that 7 days post-LH. You can stretch that all the way back to the start of the graph. They can be from fresh semen. That's the best time frame is what's marked, but, you know, they could be pregnant from any of those time frames. But certain species, if you measure progesterone or estrogen, sometimes you can actually document that they are or aren't pregnant early on. We just can't do that for dogs, which in this scenario sucks, because then we got to let them go further in their pregnancy before we can know what's going on, for one. Now, in this species, it really doesn't matter, because the problem is they're going to hang on. We can't use the protocols we're going to talk about. We can't use them effectively, even kind of like in the first few weeks. The earliest we can touch them is a couple weeks in with a certain drug that we don't have access to in the state. So as far as reasons why we might opt to terminate as owners, I've seen all of these as reasons. Genetic status with the sire and dam. So a lot of times it's, I have Aussies, I have two moral dogs that bred each other. Well, there's plenty of people who would just let those puppies be born and euthanize the double morals if they were affected with microphthalmia, if they had quality of life concerns. There are plenty of other diseases, though, that are super scary. I mean, double moral is an inconvenience. Usually it doesn't cause a severe quality of life concern. It's not ideal, but the dogs can live a wonderful life with their deficit, depending on how severely they're affected. things like I bred, like in my breed, I bred an MFE carrier to an MFE carrier. MFE is a mitochondrial disease that affects your brain. It will cause you to lose 25% of your puppies, in theory, would be dead by the time they were a year old from neurologic disease. They go blind, like really no later than 6 months. Like I would think of it almost like a mad cow kind of thing. Like they have their certain parts of their brain are just mush. They don't have normal function and they decline rapidly. They might look totally fine when they're 8 weeks old. We can't test for those things. So I guess you could euthanize those puppies after you tested for them, but it's just a really complicated situation. You know, in my breed, if you had two bull mastiffs that bred accidentally, well, if they're both MFE carriers and you didn't want to deal with the neurologic concern, you also likely are putting your bitch through a surgery. So ethically, is that okay for her to have a C-section for a potential that all of her puppies could have two copies of MFE? It's possible. Genetically, it's not the perfect mathematical way that it would come out, but it could happen. So I think for some owners that, you know, there's some diseases like that that we don't want to produce them at all because they're scary. Also, dogs that have known autosomal dominant carriers, diseases dominant just means you only have to have one copy. But that dog has one copy and you know it's going to produce that, and it's a scary disease that you don't want to produce. I think that's a reasonable idea as well. The dam's health. So sometimes it's, you know, this is a 9-year-old bitch that I don't want to be pregnant. Maybe she has a heart murmur. Maybe she's got something significant going on. I had one intentionally bred, actually. They did a full semen breeding Vizsla owner that bred a really lovely bitch who was 7. They bred her. She struggled to get pregnant, I think, prior to that, but had positive feelings about things. Well, she had a singleton and they were having some issues with. She had a brown recluse bite on her face at one point and, you know, earlier in her life. And the medication, the management of that eye and the medications that she needed to continue to manage her eye, it was not worth carrying that pregnancy. But we also didn't know the drug effects on with those certain couple of those drugs. So, you know, even an intentional bred litter that did opt to terminate. Age is like a super common one. I think older dogs usually just don't get pregnant. It's usually the younger ones. It's usually my 9-month-old puppy was bred by her dad, something like that. Is that the end of the world for her or for the sire? It's not ideal, but I think many of those young dogs can produce and whelp naturally despite the concern that she's not fully grown. Many of them can. But I think there's some discussion about, you know, we breed cows, for example, young, right? So like we have a heifer calf, we want to breed her when she's not fully mature. And we know that we're asking her to eat for her growth as well as the growth of her offspring. And it's a little bit challenging to do that effectively and end up with a really good birth weight on a calf. But we do it all the time in livestock species because the goal is we're creating more usually to eat or to produce milk. So I think in those species, we think about it all the time and it's normal. Dogs, we don't tend to do that. Is it disadvantageous for a 10-month-old Cane Corso to carry 16 puppies at 10 months old? Yeah, I think it definitely could affect how her body develops, how her top line develops, how she comes into her maturity from a number of ways, because it's very challenging for her to keep up with, simply to keep up with the litter size that they can throw, much less the fact that she is herself trying to eat to grow herself. So the other things, I think lack of genetic testing. So some people get really freaked out by that. Oftentimes we'll just test them. So I think in those scenarios, it's not perfect. We can't do a ton of films, right, for an early pregnant dog. We don't want to do a bunch of x-rays if we don't have to. But judiciously, can you take an x-ray on a pregnant dog? Yes, you can. Just don't take a series, like sometimes I'll take billions of x-rays trying to get the perfect shot. This is more a, we might get the perfect shot, but we're just going to take a shot for perspective. If she has dysplasia, well, maybe you have to terminate her. If she doesn't, then, you know, hopefully we can get testing on her down the road. And, you know, if the sled dog had testing, then maybe you feel comfortable with it. The other one that's very common is the mixed breed accidents. Like I said, I have heard of the most wild combinations of things. Where there's a will, there's a way. You would be amazed, some of these girls that are so hormonally driven that they will quite literally lay down in the grass and let a chihuahua breed them. The Chihuahua might not be super effective comparatively, like to, dog of similar size. He's not going to be able to create a tie or stimulate her in the same way, but she might lay down there for him and he might have super vigorous sperm that decide to swim all the way up there and get the job done. So, yeah, things happen. All right, so when we're talking medical versus surgical termination, medical ones are to keep her intact. That is the whole point of medical termination. Usually it's breeding futures, right? Or that she's young and, she's not ready to be pregnant for all those reasons we discussed. Sometimes it's recommended by us if we have an animal that we cannot do. Say you have a special needs dog. So say Zest, my puppy. Maybe she can't be bred and she's now a three-legged dog. Maybe she gets the amputation when she's 3 years old. We'll say. And she's bred accidentally by a dog that jumps the fence. Do I want to do surgery on her since she's kind of a complicated patient from a historical perspective? She's got kind of an awkward kind of structure to be able to put her properly onto a table to do a midline procedure. Maybe you have a dog that has a heart murmur that you didn't do a spay because she was complicated to decide what to do with her when she was young. Maybe she came back to you as a puppy back and you decided just to keep her because you can't spay her and you didn't really have a good home for that type of dog. And maybe she gets bred. Well, the rules don't change with needing to do surgery with, anesthetic risk and all that. If she wasn't a good spay candidate then, she's definitely not a good spay candidate now, right? There are, as far as the protocols go, these medical protocols, there's tons of them. So, like, they've done reviews on these. And I think whenever I was studying for boards 10 years ago, there was a summary paper with like 20 different protocols. Some of the times it's what drugs you have access to and what country that you're in. So, a lot of the variety of protocols might be that, you don't live in the United States, you live in Switzerland, and Switzerland has these other tachodynamic drugs or drugs that make your uterus active. And they have a different drug than what we have here. But what we use here, generally speaking, in the US, usually we use a combination of a couple of drugs. The main idea is they work better together. It's kind of like anesthesia. We like to use lots of small amounts of multiple things so that we don't have to use as much volume and as much drug. That is for patient comfort more than anything. So for these, those tachodynamic drugs, which just means the like uterine contraction type drugs, those drugs make you feel terrible. So the least dose we can use for those to create the effect is the best for the dog. There are different lengths of action. There's different types of prostaglandins. The most common ones that we talk about for dogs are inapras, which is luteolite. And then the other one is commonly known as estromate, which is clopidogrel, which is a longer acting, basically, than the luteolite. So that's the one I personally use. I'll talk about that a little bit. But we also want, so the things we need to do. So we need the uterus to be contracting because we need to get what's in there out of there. We need an antiluteal drug. So that means a drug that has a negative effect on the ability for the dog to keep producing progesterone. So once we get progesterone low, that's when they will relax their cervix and things that are in their uterus can leave their uterus. And then the tachodynamic drug is going to help push things out of the uterus. It does have some effects. So there's plenty of protocols and plenty of people who just use those prostaglandin injections. That's all they do. And they use them frequently. Those dogs feel worse because we're not doing as many things to affect that CL or the corpus luteum. If we use an antiluteal drug, so a drug that just has a negative impact on the CL to stay there, we don't have to use as much of that first drug, which is what we want. And then obviously for the side effects mentioned, we want to use some supportive care. It's rare that I have a dog that is sick enough that they need true supportive care, like need to be in the hospital. We're just talking, we try to head off the nausea issue to try to help them not feel crummy. They will feel crummy, but this will help a little bit with managing them. And I think if we have a dog that's really does lots of vomiting and retching, I think getting fluids is not wrong when they're in for their treatments, depending on the protocol. All right, so termination in a medical sense will either result in resorption, so meaning things go into their abdomen, like they just kind of dissolve the fetus and it dies, and then the body just kind of takes over. That is usually before 35 days if they concede and are terminated in that time frame. The actual kind of abortion of fetal material. So actually passing fluid or fetal structures can happen after that time. So usually it's more like 40 days plus that we'll see that. Some of the question though is how quickly does she take effect? So some dogs, when we do these protocols, can take a week before they start to go through things. So I would say the majority of them will either resorb or pass a little bit of fluid. But most all of the protocols that we have access to in the state, they've got to be about 4 weeks gestation, and that is their gestation, not 4 weeks from breeding per se. That's from ovulation, but roughly 4 weeks out. That's around when we can see them, but even if we check them and we can see pregnancy at 3 weeks gestation post-ovulation, I mean, it's with most modern equipment that most veterinarians have. Some veterinarians might not be confident in identifying it, but somebody like me or somebody that has a lot of radiologic experience, we can see those. We do it all the time. Like if somebody's going to a national and they're like, I really want to know if she's pregnant before we go to the national, and we're going to the national in 3 days. She was supposed to have her ultrasound next week. Can we do it today so that I can kind of have an idea if I should be talking to people about the fact that we think that she is pregnant? We can do those sorts of things. We also use it for managing like pregnancies that are much more delicate or that we're worried about resorbing, and because we're trying to keep them pregnant, we check them early in those scenarios too. So if I see that she is 24 days gestation roughly, so maybe she's a little bit on the early side, I'm going to change how I might start her protocol. I'm not going to start her today on medication, right? I'm not going to give her an injection today because it's not going to affect her properly. And it's just going to give her another uncomfortable day with me. So I also don't want to terminate after maybe 45 to 50 days gestation if we have an idea that she's due within the next week or two. The problem is, again, we're stimulating her. We basically are creating the term state. We're making her uterus active and we're making her progesterone decline. If her progesterone declines and she was due in 5 days, well, then she's just going to go into labor. And then if you end up in the C-section with a litter that you're not intending on going forward with, I mean, it's just a lot of risk on her and a lot of expense for you if we induced her kind of to lose her pregnancy around the time that she would have induced herself. So I worry about actual labor. I also worry about dystocia, even like a week out. Like, think about water puppies and malpositions, the like transverse presentation. Those, like, it's not like they just are going to pass them because they're smaller. They are smaller, so I do think it's a little less likely that they would actually have a blockage or have an issue. But I think it's rolling a lot of dice that I would not like to roll. So personally, for me, in those scenarios, there are medical options, but I will just draw the line and say surgery or bust. Some owners in those scenarios will opt to carry the litters to term and raise the puppies. But I think it just depends on the gravity of why we're terminating. So the other thing just to note, any way we terminate, whether we terminate with drugs that we have in the States, whether we get more drugs that are great for this type of thing that are from overseas, there is a shorter interestrus interval. So we have asked her body to get to the end of diestrus faster, no matter how we do it. From the end of when she got back to a baseline progesterone, she is going to have, like if she's a 6 month cycler and we took a month away from her diestrus, she's going to cycle at 5 months instead of 6 months. And that's totally normal. So it doesn't mean that she's short cycling and that she's got more problems. It just means we were successful in reducing her progesterone. I don't think I wrote anything in here on my protocol, so let me just mention it before I forget. I will check progesterone the first day we start the protocol. So the reason being, I want to see how high she is and give some projection on how long we might be treating her. The other thing I would do is a progesterone after she has fully voided everything from her uterus. There's no fluid, there's no fetal material, there's nothing left. I want to see that a few days after she has totally lost what we think was her pregnancy, I want to see the progesterone is low, because I'm going to keep her on some of those medications until her progesterone is low. They can bounce back. So some dogs will bounce back, and that is just priming them for, you know, we're playing with things coming out of her cervix. Well, something can go in there as easily as it can go out, right? If her cervix closes back up and she had a little infection that seeded upward, then she could have a pio on top of it. So my personal protocol. So we will, you call us on the phone in a panic and I will tell you, I don't want to see you for a month. So sorry. Go have a drink. I'm sorry this happened to you, but there's no reason for you to come in today unless you wanted to run a progesterone, like I said. So at about 4 weeks post natural breeding, if we know when they bred, or if you call me and you say, I have a dog that I don't know if she's pregnant because she looks pregnant, but I didn't breed her and I don't know. I have no idea. Like, I didn't even know she was cycling. That scenario we'll see right away. So obviously, if you think she's looking pregnant, I want to get to you as fast as possible. Because if you think she's looking pregnant, she's probably like pretty far along and she needs to be treated immediately. So if we ultrasound at 4 weeks, if he bred her with good timing, like he probably bred her 2 or 4 days post-ovulation, that's 4 or 6 days into these numbers that I'm stating. So it's almost like a week into things when he might bred her. So I always think if it's been 4 weeks from breeding, 5 weeks gestation is what I'm expecting to see, and I can start treatment. If she was bred a little bit early, like if he was not good with his timing and they got out a week before she would have been bred, I could still potentially start her treatment if she's 4 weeks in. So we can pretty well just visualize what they look like at this stage and get an idea of gestational age. I mean, I think if you do a lot of canine ultrasound with pregnancy, you get really good at this kind of time frame, because this is a lot of times when we're looking at them for purposeful pregnancy. So the fetus on the top, there's some calipers on there to demonstrate like how we would measure the interchorionic cavity diameter, which is what that is doing. I can tell you, I rarely personally measure it. If I am measuring it, it's for planning like an elective C-section and maybe a Frenchie that was bred without timing, something like that. But in this scenario, I can look at that and say she is roughly 28 days gestation, 26 days gestation from that. If she was 24, I wouldn't be able to see the heartbeat. If she was 30, I would see something closer to what you're seeing on the bottom. So I'd see like a length of body, you see a defined head and body, you see little limb buds. Limb buds are usually 32 days post LH is when those will show up. And in this image, you can actually see her placenta on the, basically kind of gives like a clamshell effect. You can almost imagine like there's like little finger clams sticking down. That's actually that puppy's placenta, but that is at least 35 days post LH. So there's a lot of kind of markers that are very subtle, but are very clear at this particular time frame, so we can get an idea. So I'll usually initiate treatments starting at about 35 days plus. And then like we talked about before, we don't want to do things after maybe 45 or 50 days. I think you're starting to flirt with fire waiting that long. Sometimes you don't get a choice, but. So we'll, first day, we'll run a progesterone. We'll pre-medicate with some anti-nausea meds if we're going to be treating with clopidogrel, which is the longer acting prostaglandin that I prefer. We'll also sometimes send Serenia home between treatments so you can give it daily kind of between the times that we're going to be getting the injections in a hospital. And then during that same appointment, after we've given a little bit of time, like 10 or 15 minutes for that Serenia to kick in, we will give a microdose prostaglandin, which is clopidogrel. And we do that every 2 to 3 days under the skin and then walk her aggressively. I should say aggressively is like kind of a strange word, but walk her with intention immediately after giving this. She will feel crummy 60 seconds after I give that injection. So we will check the client out. We will prep them for their next appointment. We will get them set up for their next appointment. We will get whatever needed to be signed. I want to inject that medication, have the owner take it outside and take it for a walk, because the more activity they have, whether it be luteolase or estrogenate, which is this drug, I want her to be walking around, because her signs how crummy she feels, her like nausea and stuff will be less if she's active for about 10 or 15 minutes. She will still feel bad after that, but she will have less immediate clinical signs. These dogs will almost immediately try to vomit. Like 60 seconds, 90 seconds in, they will be retching or getting nauseous or licking their lips. They don't feel good. The other thing we're going to be giving is a oral compounded med. So we have a, you can get this compounded through like a third party pharmacy, like an online pharmacy, certain ones, Wedgewood, Roadrunner, some of those guys. The other place that we like to get it is just a local animal compounder. If they do the compounding process locally, we can usually get it back like tomorrow, which is great. So I will try to time that I have cabergoline available in the same time frame that we start the clopidogrel injections, because we need both of those things to be in their system for this to really work well as quickly as possible. So sometimes I will, if the owner's not at a distance, I'll have them come back, pick up their drugs for the oral stuff, start the injections, but start the oral drugs too in the same day. Then we recheck them and retreat every 2 or 3 days. until they're done. So they're going to be on that cabergoline at home, and then they're going to come back for their injections at the hospital. We ultrasound them, we check, we talk to them about, have you seen anything? I would say 95% of the time the owner describes, yeah, she was just licking herself a lot yesterday, or a tiny pool of darkish fluid I could see on the ground, and she cleaned it up like faster than I could tell. But that's the only thing that's happened. And usually when that has been described, we will ultrasound that dog and it will have a pristine, completely void of anything, fluid, fetal structure, anything like that. Uterus will just be totally pristine and not need any further treatment. But once we see that with ultrasound, that's when we run that follow-up progesterone and confirm we don't need to stay any longer on the oral med. If we have a low progesterone, I will tell them to continue the oral med for 2 days and then they can discontinue. So the other thing that can be used, I don't use it often with this protocol, but we use this protocol kind of similarly, not exactly the same, but kind of use this protocol for pyometra treatment too. Same kind of general idea, except much more tight timelines on things and they're hospitalized. But mifepristone, and that should say pristone, P-R-I-S-T-O-N-E. Mifepristone is something that can be used to help with cervical opening. Mifepristone has been famous for being involved in Supreme Court cases and being discussed as like not being available in the United States soon. So I sure hope that doesn't happen because we'll have a lot more pile bitches that I can't fix, but it can be used here. So if you had a dog that I couldn't get the uterus to clear, I might use it as an addition because it just helps with cervical relaxation. So it helps the cervix to just kind of relax and let everything free. We're basically all of these things that we're doing, we're trying to get the cervix to open. That is basically what we're doing, all the things that we're doing. So most patients will, with this protocol, most patients will respond in between 1 and 3 injections. I would say the 1 injection is very, very rare. I've had it, but, and they're a lucky owner. It's a super cheap approach if you only needed to get treated one time. But obviously you can guess with all these treatments, visits, ultrasounds, et cetera, it's not cheap to do this. It is cheaper for most owners. It is cheaper to spay them than to do all this. But for our purposes, obviously she's got some inherent value going forward in most cases. So we're happy to kind of stomach that to deal with it. So I know we already talked about the side effects, but GI side effects, I don't expect them to eat the whole time that we're doing this. I just expect them to like graze and maybe touch some high value stuff. That is not a big medical concern for a dog. It is okay if it's not ideal, but we expect them not to be super hungry. So every once in a while, this is going on and there's a big show next weekend and she's hard to keep weight on. I'm like, I mean, we can wait until next week, but I would just say, you know, she's going to look pregnant at the show if she starts to put on weight related to that. Sometimes we just have to do things, you know, around what makes sense for the owner's schedule and things. All right, so I know probably like 20% of you guys have been jumping out of your seats waiting for me to talk about Alizone. Alizone is also called aglepristone. So this is a drug that is not available in the United States. Are people in the United States using this drug? Yes, they are. There is a way to get individualized approval in the U.S. through the FDA. So you have to call them and fill out some paperwork and submit it for your animal. So Susie Klein's dog called Princess is going to have this drug. And the reason that she is getting this drug is because there's a very specific medical need that I cannot serve with any labeled United States drugs, right? This drug is not produced in the U.S., period. It's not. Everything we get of this drug comes from another country. The United States FDA does not like that. They don't like it. There is a way to get provisional approval as a practice. There's been some discussion about how some practices have managed to get a sign-off in a bottle and that they do use it on different patients, but it's a little bit gray and the loophole is maybe okay, but I can tell you as a person that works in this industry, there are very few drugs that have a, you cannot use this off-label label. There are very few. The couple of the ones that we want in the United States are the ones that have it. It's not an off-label use. It is a, you are not supposed to use this in any species other than X, Y, and Z use. So that's the case of Superloren. If you guys are familiar with Superloren, that's a drug, it's a GnRH drug that we can order. Virbac produces it. There's a company that makes it, but they only make it for ferrets. You cannot use it for other species. This drug, we've been trying to get this drug in this country for 15 years. Will we get it? I would say 98% confidence that we will never see this drug in the United States. And the reason is because everybody wants to talk about abortion in this country. This drug is great at aborting things, people too. So I don't think it's ever going to be here because they don't want people having access to a drug. They, I shouldn't say they. I think there is enough controversy over abortion in the United States that, and opinions, I'm going to leave opinions out of that, right? There are plenty of people that will stand up and say, I completely don't believe in it. I've worked with people in medicine that feel that way, that they just philosophically do not believe in it. And those people don't want there to be a drug that a partner could inject his partner or her partner in the night and not wake up to it, but have been poked in the butt with something that caused them to chronically miscarry and they don't know why. Like there's stuff like that can happen. And the drug companies don't want to touch, like the drug companies that are out there that make things, they don't want to go into like a legal soup with a new drug that could do things like that. And I just don't think if we were having, if before everything has been changed in the last year or so relating to abortion legality and access to drugs and the discussion about it, if we didn't get it last year before all that stuff happened and we're going back to, state control or, whatever ends up happening, I just can't possibly see how this is going to happen because we've been trying to get it for 10 years and we didn't have all those controversies going on. And we couldn't get it then. So I just don't imagine it. Now, what if your vet has used this or offers it to you? If they do, I'm saying this as a veterinarian who very much loves my colleagues. I think there are lots of people who don't know that they're not really supposed to be using it. If they have conditional approval, that's different. But if they don't, if you're naive and you thought it was extra label, that you thought it was just off label and that you could use it because your client brought it to you. That's fair. Like you can defend that. If it truly was innocence, you might get a slap on the wrist as a veterinarian. Someone like me, I know a lot about this drug. I know where we have access to it. I know how to use it. I know why we can't really get access to it in the US. Someone like me is not going to be able to defend that I was naive to knowing about the drug. So I think just be very careful, protect your veterinarian, and we don't want them to get in the sticks if they didn't need to be in the sticks. And being legal about how you're using things is important. Oh, just so you know, though, so we love this drug. We love this drug. We wish we had this drug for pyo treatment. We wish you had this drug for many things. It's a cool drug. It's an anti-progesterone compound. So it doesn't actually cause the CL to go away, but it causes, it directly competes progesterone out of your bloodstream. So it will make you lose whatever was in your uterus because your progesterone will decline, your cervix will open, and it, things go bye-bye. They are subcutaneous injections, so pretty easy to administer. It is super expensive, that I've been aware of. It's a single injection at 2 to 3 weeks post-breeding, I think is still the kind of common approach. And then you ultrasound the week after kind of the final injection, or maybe again, a week after that. They do not have the terrible GI crap that we give with the prostaglandin group, and they achieve the same exact kind of approach. We can also treat them earlier in pregnancy. So some people really like the idea of that. I don't know that it really makes a big difference. 4 weeks gestation, nobody's showing significant signs of pregnancy. But I mean, perhaps they come back to their same previous attitude or, there might be other benefits. But yeah, the only side effect is a weird one. They can cause, when you give the injection, we usually give it in a weird spot, like under the armpit area, carefully, things like that, because it can cause the coat in the area to go white and it will permanently discolor the coat if it does that. We don't know exactly why that happens, but obviously, if we're treating a dog that's actively being shown and it's very important that that dog stay the color that it is, then we need to make sure we're mindful of that. I guess the other approach you could take is you could inject it in places the coat is already white if you have a breed that has white on it. So like I said, we also love this drug because we could use it for pyo. It's great for pyo, getting things to connect. It takes a lot longer for us to use the drugs that we currently have, but we still have to use other things. It's not that you can just go in for one injection and pyo is treated, but it's a really nice drug. But just a few little minor mentions. I know we're pretty close to time here. I don't have too much on surgical termination for obvious reasons. I know our focus is really not so much the surgical termination side, but you might have a puppy buyer that calls you for counseling just to say, like, I don't know what to do. I think for many owners, if the dog is of reasonable age to spay or has not a lot of significant evidence to say that, younger stays are not an ideal situation for that breed. I think stay is the easiest thing to do. The first 4 weeks post-breeding, their uterus is like hardly recognizably pregnant, truly. It will look a little different. Texturally, it feels a little different, but the size will not change hardly at all. So I just put this picture on here for some reference, but you can see the size of the clamp here and like the width of the clamp. And basically this is like maybe like a half an inch of tissue as far as the width goes. There's almost no blood vessel like kind of buildup or anything like that. I think it's a really good approach to terminating SPM. I think you can do, so an ovariohysterectomy means you take the ovaries and uterus out. I prefer that as a procedure, personally. I do ovarectomies and OSSs as well. The ovarectomy will work because you are removing the progesterone. If you fully removed the ovary, it will work. I think there's just not a lot of study on it. It makes me a little bit uncomfortable. So I would say I feel more comfortable removing the uterus too and saying like she is not pregnant anymore. The other kind of weird discussion idea, can we do an OSS for dogs that the intention for that dog was not to be stayed and they're in the position that they're in, sometimes like weird circumstances. I had a guy that was driving from like 5 hours away from me. He couldn't facilitate bringing a dog he had a young giant breed dog. He was 9 or 10 months old. The other dog in the home broke the door down, right, and bred the bitch. And so now she's potentially pregnant. We were talking about options, and he said, I thought about an OSS. The OSS makes me a little bit nervous. I hadn't signed some things because the thing is I have to leave a little bit of her uterus, a tiny bit, but it's still a bit of her uterus on the side of the ovary that I leave. So if I leave an ovary, I have to, because of how dogs are made, I have to leave a tiny bit of her uterus. So I think I've done it once. It was a creative solution because she was a young giant breed dog. He's very concerned about hip dysplasia from the history of the dog's line. And they were planning to neuter the male, but they did not want to have a litter of puppies, potentially a large litter from a breed that tends to carry like 12 puppies. So just was not practical. So that was a kind of creative loophole solution. I think it's a very rare situation where I will encourage OSS to make sense as a termination option. But obviously, if you remove the uterus in its entirety, you have removed most opportunities for pregnancy in those scenarios, but they will still have a high progesterone. Sorry about the graphic nature. So these are actually fetal losses that I pulled in a C-section, but I just wanted to give you guys some idea of what you can describe to people if you're trying to counsel maybe a puppy buyer that's going through this, like what they're in for. These are not fun to do this, right? Like they need to be prepared. If they're terminating kind of later in gestation medically, they're going to see this kind of thing present. These are a little bit further along as far as when they died, so like what these would look like, but it's going to be this kind of blackish red fluid color. It's most common. Sometimes it will just be fluid, like I said earlier on, it'll just be fluid, but I just thought these might be good visuals to kind of get an idea of things. And you can see the size of like this one on the left. That's a forcep that's about probably 5 inches long, the forcep. And there's that is fetus with some fetal membranes as well, which are things that they can see. If we're far enough along that we can't, so say you just noticed that she was pregnant, this happens sometimes, just noticed that she was pregnant. Maybe she's, you know, you were gone for a few weeks and you came back from a national and she was at home and she didn't look pregnant at all when she left because she has two, maybe. And then when you came back, you're like, oh my gosh, she's like lactating and she looks like she's like dropped in her abdomen, like she looks pregnant. Those dogs, it might not be ideal to terminate, like we talked about. We don't want to see this, and we don't want to put her at risk of needing an emergency C-section. So uterotomy is a fancy way of saying the same thing we do for a C-section. So this is the picture on the right of the uterus. That is a term uterus. This is a C-section, a Sussex Spaniel that had 6 puppies. Puppies were probably 10-ounce puppies, 12-ounce puppies, something like that. We can go in. They don't have to be term, but if they are in the last couple weeks of gestation, we can take the uterus out of the abdomen the same way that we do for a C-section, make an incision, remove all the fetuses through that incision, close her up, clean everything up, put the uterus back, and it's done. It is possible to do that. Now, just like a regular C-section, hopefully your surgeon doesn't leave anything, right? These should be well-developed, not missable, right? Like they're all going to be due in a week, probably something like that. Not perfect. I would say this is mostly common with things like first time Frenchie owner who thought they would go out and have a breeding program, and their 9 month old dog started to look kind of pregnant, and it's super pregnant, and they just didn't know what they were doing yet, and it got bred by the neighbor's dog. Well, those dogs, we don't want to, if they want to terminate the pregnancy, just, schedule from a surgical perspective rather than saying, like, let's free whelp her. Obviously, that's not going to be an option for a dog like that. If she's true term, it's a little tricky. We don't have, like, we wouldn't necessarily know a true term scenario. There's going to be plenty of veterinarians who refuse to do this. So just be prepared that that might be where you end up. Most veterinarians will be willing to do what's called an in-block C-section. They remove the uterus and ovaries as a one-stop shop, like handed off as a bulk unit. That is the way that we used to euthanize puppies in shelters that were like a close to term, unknown origin dog that's in for a spay. Whoops, she's pregnant while she's in there. We don't like to do that if we don't have to. I mean, I know that they're not alive for much time, right? But they do, we've measured like fetal cortisol is high in those scenarios. It's not as positive of an experience, even for something that's going to be alive for a very short period of time or sensing for a short period of time. And it's important that we are cognizant of that. I know, we're thinking of, I hate to say, like, we're thinking in like a disposal setting, but I think doing an end block is not something that I will ever do in practice. It's just not what I believe in. So what we usually do is remove puppies, don't make extraordinary measures, obviously, to resuscitate, and we might use a lot of anesthesia for her, make sure that they're totally out of it. Most puppies will, if they're maybe a week out, they're not going to even respond. We're not going to have any fetal activity. They're going to be DOA when they're delivered. If they're -4 or -5 days, they might be what's called agonal or kind of gas. They might have some changes that are normal body responses to something's happening, but they're not actually cognizant, we don't think. But in those cases, we euthanize individually. So we'll give medication into the heart if that was, if we saw any signs of activity that would suggest that that fetus could be feeling or responding to things. I have plenty of staff that I tell every time I work anywhere, I say, you do not have to do these procedures. They are controversial, but this is a really hot topic, and be cognizant of that. Even if you're talking with other breeders, your friends, like, you'd be surprised. Like I said, I had a mentor who was boarded in Therio, and she is happy to terminate a pregnancy in a horse with a finger. Like, she will do a decapitation in an equine foal, which is a whole other topic. But there's lots of ways that we euthanize horses with our hands in utero. And she will not do an injectable medical termination for a dog. It's just a different category. It's like in her, she doesn't believe in abortion in people. So, like, it just bleeds over into her feelings in practice. And as practitioners, we can make decisions on that, individually. I don't feel that way. I think we have a, there's a place for this. It's, you just have to be very delicate with how you handle it. So lastly, should we just let her carry? I know we kind of touched on this. There's scenarios where I think the answer is yes. I think a lot of people end up choosing this, but there's sometimes where we just flat out can't choose this as an option. I don't think because she's so young is a really good reason to terminate, but we do it for people if that's what they decide. I think the nutritional argument we talked about, are they able to whelp because they're young? It's like teenage moms. How many teenage moms have a baby in the bathroom at school, right? It happens. And they are maybe at a little bit higher risk of dystocia, but I don't think it's humans, we're having one giant baby. These guys, we really don't have the problem. So I think more is there a risk for emergency assistance coverage? Is she going to get stayed because she goes to a local ER for her C-section? And if that's not the goal and we don't want to put her through that risk, then maybe the termination approach is the better approach. So I know we've already beat this to death, and we'll go to questions here. Basically, consider your options, consider your plans. There's lots of different equations of how this works out. I think knowing what your options are locally is not a bad idea. Asking your vet, like when you're in for a wellness, just to see what they have options for things is a good idea, but you'll probably have about a month to figure it out, right? If it happens to you. So, Nicole, if you voice any questions, I'm sorry, I know we, as always, I can always promise to run over.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hesser. The great news is, I think you've actually answered all of the questions that we received, which tells me that we did a great job. So we don't have any questions, but thank you so much for doing this with us. I think our community learned so much from you, as always. We're so grateful to have you here. And thank you to everyone who joined. If you are not yet a member of our community, you can sign up, learn more about our mission. And I just want to leave everyone with a sneak peek of our next webinar because it's actually coming up pretty quickly. So it's going to be on Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Eastern. And it's going to be with Dr. Victor Stora, who was here with us a few months ago. And the topic is infertility in stud dogs. So kind of a nice companion piece to what we just learned here. So we're going to have that announced and up for registration so everyone can RSVP for that. And again, that's Wednesday, September 3rd. So coming up pretty quickly. And I do see a quick question from Rebecca if there's a recording of this presentation. Yes, that's going to be up later today. So you can take a look at that, share it. We love sharing this kind of information. So we encourage you to do so as well. But thank you all so much for being here. And we will see you at our next webinar. And thank you, Dr. Hester. It's so great to see you. Hi, everyone. Thank you.
Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Good Dog Pod. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, so be sure to subscribe to the Good Dog Pod on your favorite podcast platform.